stored your memories of your life. As a physician in New Hope, I understand you've been here for 52 years now, is that right?
I'm going into my 52nd year.
You're going into your 52nd year, and this is for the New Hope Historical Society. My name is Rita Duran, and it's just delightful to be here on this lovely summer Sunday afternoon. I think it's July 28, 1985, right?
Right.
And I thank you so much for showing all your beautiful paintings, all the Pennsylvania artists, and especially the New Hope artists. You have such a lovely collection. At first, I'd like to ask you some questions about your background, you know, where you were born and how you happened to come to New Hope. Were you born in this community or in this area?
As a matter of fact, I'm originally from North Dakota. And I went to the school at the University of North Dakota, but we had to transfer then. I transferred then to the University of Pennsylvania. I graduated from Penn Medical School in 31. And I interned at Philadelphia General Hospital from 31 to 33. Then is the question what I was going to do. Well, the doctor out home in North Dakota wanted me to come back and go in with him. But they offered me a very, very nice position down in the hospital. And I was debating about what to do with this and figuring that I'd better go and get to work because I had been going to school on borrowed money and I thought I'd better get to busy paying it back. Well, I finally passed up the opportunity there at the hospital, and 2 days later I had this phone call from my brother and the doctor. Said you better take that job because they were in the midst of the drought and the dust storms in the Midwest and they wanted to see what would happen to the economy out there. Well, there I was without anything. In 1928, I had had a cousin, Raymond Livey, who had been in practice here in New Hope, and he had been killed while he was out making a call. The train hit him down at Titusville. And I had been up here in the winter time and looked at New Hope. In fact, I subsequently knew of four other people who were interested in coming into New Hope that year. Well, I came back up, a friend of mine who worked at the RCA Victor in Camden had a car, and he brought me up here on the 4th of July. And we came over, as we approached the valley, we got to the top of the hill, I said, wait a minute. And I got out of the car and I said, look at this valley. I said, this is it. And that made the decision, and then I began, and my cousin's widow helped me then decide on where to go. And my original practice was down in the building that Dr. Ricker finally came into. I had bachelor's quarters there for a year, because I facetiously say I didn't know whether I was going to buy a hamburger, have enough money to buy a hamburger for two people. So after going scrounging around through the better furniture, second-hand furniture places on Market Street in Philadelphia, I picked up furniture for the outfit, the apartment, came up here and got started, opened my practice on the 9th of October, 1933. And as I went out to open the door at 8 o'clock in the morning, there was a little lady sitting on the front step waiting to get in.
Oh, do you remember who she
My was? First patient was Mrs. Everett, the grandmother of our local current chief of police.
Oh.
And she was the first patient that I had.
Did you save her the fee that you received? Usually they're they save the dollar or three or whatever.
Well,
it was.
Well, they were dollar fees.
Really?
For the office visits were dollar and a half.
Really?
for
oh.
home calls. I knew Dr. Erdman out in Buckingham, and he was getting along in years, and the people here thought I was really very busy because as soon as office hours were over, I would get my little black bag, get into my car, and I would get on the way. And I'd either go out to Buckingham and go with him on calls and carry his big bag for him and go with him, or I'd go around the country to get acquainted with the roads so that if someone called me in the middle of the night, I'd have some landmarks to go by. Well, We were, as I say, I lived there for a year. In 1934, we were married.
Married.
Winifred Rainford.
Winifred
Ranger.
She had been an
X-ray technician in the hospital where I interned, Philadelphia General. And we moved here. And in fact, the first night we spent in this big house was the 9th of May in 1935.
Oh, you bought this house right away?
Well, the little old lady that lived here was a patient of mine, and she had told me that Raymond Leiby had said that if she ever decided to sell it, he wanted first chance at it. And I said, well, I would like to have first chance at it if you want to sell it. Well, she had some differences with her niece who was going to inherit her estate. Mm-hmm. And she told me, she said, if you get me on my feet so I can go to the bank, she said, I will give you that house. I said, Miss Annie, I don't want it that way, but I would like to buy it from you. So I got Mr. Worthington from the bank here and Mr. Whiteley from the bank over in Lambertville to come and talk to her. I got Dr. Salmon and Dr. Williams, the older doctors, to come and talk to her so as I'd have backing to say that I didn't take advantage of the little old lady. And she sold it to me at that time for a very reasonable price. But of course, as Mr. Large said, when I asked him what it was worth, he said, Mr. Large, incidentally, was the leading contractor around here at that time. And he said, well, who would want the place in the first place? He says, it's too big. Well, in that time, in those days, I mean, how would you heat it? I mean, that alone was a problem. And he said, it's too big. Nobody would want it. But he said, if they'd get $7,000 for it, it would probably be all they could possibly get for it. This house was originally built by a man by the name of Cook. He at that time owned the hardware store across the street, and his wife wanted the largest house in town, so he built her this. Well, eventually he went bankrupt, and at bankrupt sale, a man by the name of Crook bought it, and I bought it from Annie Fanny Crook.
Oh, no.
in 1935. So we've done a lot to it since then. But the fact of the matter is, it had a coal-burning furnace in it, but it was so inadequate that you couldn't heat the house properly with it. The well was a dug well, about 15 feet deep out in the back, and every time we had a rain, we'd get black water because all that lot behind us was a coal yard. They used to bring the coal down the canal and barges, and then unloaded in there in the coal yard, and they just serve it delivered from there. But we've done a lot, of course, obviously done a lot to it since
we have to dig a new well.
Oh yes, we had it dug and drilled.
A real deep one.
Drilled one. In fact, it was good enough so that at one time we furnished water to the church, and one time the Logan Inn well was bad. We furnished water to them. We furnished water to the post office, the liquor store, and the apartments overhead, and the little house back by the canal. Well, later I bought 47. I bought the lot back there and moved the barn and that little house from this lot back onto that. We always had access to this property on the original deed through that coal yard. Reading in the deed, it reads with ingress and egress to the width of a load of hay.
Oh,
that's
the
way.
That's the size of it now.
That's that's the way it got into this property.
Well, that was very clever.
Yes.
It was good that you were protecting them. But what a fantastic price! Do you have any idea what this home is worth today? It must be worth an awful lot of money.
We won't talk about it.
I know that the Perry Mansion was purchased for $65,000. I think that was about 25 years ago.
The Perry Mansion, of course, I've been interested in the New Hope Historical Society since its inception. We wouldn't have that Perry Mansion today if it weren't for Arthur Ricker and some of Arthur Ricker's friends. When that was bought, you may not be aware of it, but he had to have some co-signers. I mean, the Historical Society didn't have credit enough to sign that note. So he got some of us to co-sign the note.
Really?
But I must admit that I didn't co-sign that note on the feeling of the dependency of the Historical Society. I signed that Dr. Ricker's association.
That was a terrible loss.
Yes,
Dr.
it was.
Dr. Ricker's been gone about 3 years now, three
yes,
or 4 years?
Four years.
4 years.
Yeah.
And he died of bee stings.
Bee stings.
Yes. Mrs. Ricker is still very interested in everything you do.
Yes.
Is a very, you know, energetically supports things that we are into.
If you have talked to the Hedges and Jim McGill, they have probably told you about this town as it used to be. I mean, we used to have trees down South Main Street, like they have up on North Main Street. When I first came here, there used to be a sort of a general store across the street.
Yes.
Maybe they told you about that. Mrs. Frank's
store. They told me about the ice cream store and the salt water that was thrown on the trees.
And Mrs. Frank's general store across the street here. Yes. I was telling somebody, in the early days, they didn't have the snow removal equipment that they have today, and these streets would be knee-deep in snow here until for maybe a couple of days after a big snowstorm. I was telling somebody last night about Mr. Bear had a tavern down where the bookstore is now, and when that would close up, some of these fellows would go home up North Main Street. You could hear them. They were both of them deaf, and they were going up in the middle of the street, knee-deep in snow, talking to each other half a block apart. You could hear them all the way up Main Street. Things were a lot quieter in New Hope then than they are now, that's for sure.
Was the canal still in operation at that time?
It closed, I think, in 31.
So you came here right after the canal.
Yes.
Closed, and so this must have caused an additional depression in this area.
Well, I don't know how much the canal at that time wasn't really doing anything in this particular area. They were going. I can remember when I was in school, a classmate of mine's folks had a place up at Lumberville, and we spent one weekend up there, and we went down to the canal and saw one of the barges where the people were down there spending the night at the lock. You know, these families lived on these barges. I had a patient that told me as a youngster, he grew up, his father was drove the mule team that hauled those barges,
yeah.
And he used to go along riding the mule with a big switch to keep the flies off the mules.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's really such a colorful area, too. I understand there were rafts going down the rivers, but they sort of preceded the canal, didn't they? There were raft people, and the rafts were just made of logs.
I don't remember ever seeing it.
I wondered how long they were in operation, because there were whole families that would live on the rafts.
Yeah, I don't remember ever seeing it. That must have been much earlier.
Much earlier, probably. Well, tell me, you came here then during the Depression.
That's right.
And actually went to school during the heart of the Depression.
That's right.
It must have been a
That's why I got my student loan at 4% interest.
Oh, dear. Do you remember what tuition was in those days at Penn?
But I think I paid $1,100 the first year and $1,200 the second year.
Oh, my. You pay that much for a three-credit course now at least, don't you?
Yes. I think it's about $1,000 now.
Yes. Right. I know my husband graduated from Illinois in 41, and he paid $31 a semester.
Well, he was a state resident.
Right.
Yes.
Right. But you were from out of the
state.
Yeah,
I was out of state.
So it cost you $400.
$1,200 the second year, I was there.
$1,200. My goodness. But you had already graduated from college in
the University of North Dakota. I got my Bachelor of Arts degree there, and then they had a two-year medical school.
Oh.
And we had to transfer. Most of them transferred into Chicago area. I petitioned at Northwestern and got an acceptance from them, and I petitioned Penn, and of course as soon as I said anything about Penn, I couldn't have changed my mind. The dean out there had a leave of absence from our school, from North Dakota, 1 year, and he taught anatomy at Penn for a year, and as soon as I said something about Penn, he was as enthusiastic about it as I was.
Yes, well, I know Northwestern well, because I'm from the Chicago area.
Yeah.
And I think you've made a very wise choice.
Well, it used to be Rush was the leading one, but Rush was going down and Northwestern was coming up.
Right.
But I've never regretted the fact of going to Penn.
Oh, I should say not. I imagine it was difficult to be in practice at a time like that. Having been a patient many times, I know I had childhood diseases that we don't even hear about today, like diphtheria,
well,
scarlet fever, and
yes,
things like that.
Of course,
it's a different picture now.
If you remember back in those days, if anyone had scarlet fever, we put a red banner on the front door quarantining them there for 21 days. Well, today you don't see a full-blown case of scarlet fever. They give them penicillin and it knocks the whole thing right out in just no time.
In fact, I think they call it scarlatina or something.
Well, they used to refer to the mild case of scarlatina and the more severe case of scarlet fever.
And that was such a devastating thing.
Well, the biggest difficulty was usually the complications. Very frequently they had bad ears with mastoids. There's another thing. When I first began practice, it wasn't a winter went by, but what I would send five or six youngsters to somebody to be operated on for mastoid operation. Since the advent of the antibiotics, I haven't seen but one case of mastoid, and that was a girl that was going to school away from here, and she wasn't followed up properly at school, and when she came back here, I said, well, you've got a mastoid out of that thing, and so I sent her, and that's the only case of mastoid I've seen since we began using the antibiotics. Peculiar, I'll tell you an interesting story about the first beginning using antibiotics. We used to use sulfanilamide, of course, and that used to produce sulfhemoglobin, which was sometimes given sort of a cyanosis. They'd give them a blue coloring. And I had a fellow up in North Main Street here that had a bad sore throat, and we were just beginning to use the sulfa drugs. And I put him on the sulfa drug and went back to see him a couple of days to follow up on it. And I came in the bedroom and looked at him, and his lips were purple. And my heart dropped down to my boots. And he says, say, that stuff is good. You know, shortly after I began taking it, my throat began to feel better. He says, I ate a good breakfast. And he says, I just got through drinking a glass of grape juice.
Oh.
I said, well, thank God it was grape juice. And here it was, the grape juice was coloring his lips, not the sulfa drug.
Reactions to sulfa can be pretty,
yes,
dangerous. Even if we think of reactions to penicillin as being lethal, but reactions to sulfa can be quite life-threatening.
Yes.
How about epidemics? Did you ever have epidemics here?
I had several patients in a locality down on Waterloo Street here. They were getting the water out of the local well, out of a hand pump. And I had about four or five patients down there in that corner who developed typhoid. But they all got well. We condemned the well, we closed the well, and I treated all of them, and they all got well, in spite of everything.
Oh.
The thing that, of course, in the summertime, people don't realize what we went through each summer in the fear of polio, the polio season, so-called, and about youngsters going swimming and about having their tonsils out and all those things that were not done in the summer for fear of getting polio. Well, with the possibility of the relief of polio by the vaccine we have, there is no excuse for everybody not having it. And it, peculiarly enough, it's surprising how many people do not have the vaccine under protection.
Well, I suppose that's true. But I know that all of my children and grandchildren have it. And at the time that it became available, I was expecting a child. And so I have vaccine in my children under a certain age.
One time, I used to be the school physician here for years, and they asked me to give a talk on immunization, and it was in front of the PTA, and I said, I'm glad to have a captive audience. I said, I'm speaking more to you older folks than I am about the youngsters. Now, you're all very conscientious about bringing your youngsters to the doctor and having them go through with their immunizations, but what are you doing for yourselves, particularly you folks that work around the gardens and the farm, on the farms and around the gardens? What are you doing about the tetanus shots? Protect yourself against tetanus. And I said, it's so simple to do. And now I said, you don't think about it for yourself, but you do think about it for your children.
For children, that's right.
And you could go out in the garden, step on a rake, and contract tetanus.
Just so and so quickly.
But those things are something we don't see today. Unfortunately, they're getting some kicks or some side effects from some of these vaccines that they are practically putting the vaccine people out of business because of the fear of malpractice suits from reactions to the vaccines.
Oh my goodness, really?
Right.
That's terrible. Oh, and this is outrageous. Because I remember the days when I was myself a child and also raising little children and what a tremendous benefit that was. And then the shots that we had for things that I had as a child, whooping cough, diphtheria, scarlet fever.
Yeah, whooping cough, diphtheria, and tetanus. That was three of them you got in one shot.
That's
DPT,
right.
And then the tetanus is extra.
It's just amazing that people just don't take advantage of the things that are available to
right.
them. They did a lot of tonsillectomies in those days, and they don't do them anymore.
No, as a matter of fact, I think we talk as strongly today about not doing them as we used to talk. In fact, there used to be two procedures that the youngsters had to go through before they went to school. One was the immunizations. The smallpox vaccine was one of the things that had to be done. We don't have smallpox vaccines today. But the vaccinations and the tonsillectomies were almost a routine procedure before they started school. In fact, I used to do tonsillectomies here in this house.
Yeah.
Up on the third floor, I had one room fixed up as an operating room. And the nurse from the anesthetist from the hospital used to come over in the morning and give the anesthesia, and we'd do two or three tonsils in the morning before we'd start office hours.
Oh.
And had the room across the way, the recovery room. They'd stay there all day long and then go home that
what
night.
What great price did you get for that
tonsil? Yes.
$25.
Oh my goodness.
And $5 of that I gave to the anesthetist. A messenger.
Oh, I'm so glad you did. The thing is, we were talking about the condition of medicine in the 30s and how things have changed. And it's a shame that people didn't take advantage of what is available to them. You suppose they'll find a cure for cancer and then people get callous about that and they won't take whatever
vaccine. We still have a long ways to go. They are making inroads on cancer and leukemia, some of these dreaded things. This very dear friend of mine, a fellow that I was nursing to his brother, I was best man at their wedding out in North Dakota back in 1930. Jerry he was teaching at the University of Minnesota, the Department of Bacteriology and Immunology. He was working on research problems of cancer, leukemia, rheumatic fever, and there was another one, four of them. But in fact, he was working with Dr. Salk at the time of development of this, polio was the other
and
one, polio vaccine.
Yes.
Actually, we used to, when I was in school, we used to talk about a filterable virus. Well, the only thing we knew that there was something there is because they'd make a culture medium of this whatever was causing the infection and pass it through what we call a Birkfeld filter, which is an unglazed filter medium, an unglazed filter, and then take that medium and put it into an animal, a guinea pig or a rabbit, and induce the disease in them, showing that it was a filterable virus. It was something that went through that fluid. They couldn't see, they couldn't determine it, they had no microscopes that detected, they couldn't see it. And yet they could produce
there.
A disease. It was still there. Today, they not only see them on these new ultra microscopes, in fact, at the University of Minnesota, when Jerry and I stopped to see Jerry one time, we went out there and he took me up, I saw the virus of polio virus under one of these electron microscopes.
Oh. It's amazing.
And now they only, they identify them and name them and mark, number them, and they qualify them just like they did of the original bacteria.
You don't realize how strong those microscopes are until you have seen a film that I saw in which it magnified the eyelid and it showed little mites walking on the eyelid that were actually microbes of some kind that were walking on the eyelids. That's it. We don't realize that we just live in a world that
we're running around with insects all over.
Right. But they're really amazingly strong. It's wonderful that we can see them. Do you remember some patients that you might have taken care of that might have left some kind of an impression in your mind here in New York? Anybody, you were talking about Mira Nakashima, and said you sewed her up a few times.
Oh, yes.
I thought you might have,
Well, one outstanding, you see, I used to deliver babies. Oh. I've delivered over 2,500 of them altogether. Oh. I had one patient over at Lambertville I've delivered 13 times. It got to be a yearly routine procedure. They'd call me up in the middle of the night, not scream and yell at them because she hadn't been here for any prenatal visits or anything. Oh. I'd go over there and just no time at all, as I facetiously say, I'd catch it on the first bounce.
I understand there was one family here with 18. Was it the Voorhees family?
Well, the Voorhees. Well, I've delivered some of them also.
Did you really? Oh, I understand they had them every year too. And, that was really
is that
quite a number.
One we worked for.
Really. Is there anyone else that might have been outstanding as a patient? You know, as a personality that you.
How would Paul White have been?
He had cancer phobia. He was always coming up with symptoms. He was sure was relaying it. He was going to have cancer. As a matter of fact, one time they were here, we had a party, and he had some guests from Philadelphia, and he brought them in. Says, this man has talked me out of more cancers than you can think of. Well, I used to talk him out of the cancers, and wouldn't you know, he got up one morning and had a fatal heart attack.
Nobody gets out of here alive. Right. Well,
feet first or nothing.
The thing is, there were people right across the street here who were rather well known who were appearing at the Playhouse. Did anybody ever need any services
from the Playhouse? Oh, yes.
Some really
we used to see them every once in a while. As I say, probably the only one in town that. What was the sorority's name? Williams, was it the gal?
Oh, Esther Williams.
Esther Williams.
I didn't know she was here.
Oh. I had to give her a shot of penicillin, and you know where.
Oh, my goodness, really?
The best butt in town.
I hope this is the
No, we, I've
she,
had...
This is really being great, yes. But she was really just a fabulous lady, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Wonderful. So and she's beautiful today.
Yes, I saw
it.
It's
just
beautiful.
Helen, just lovely.
You're a real lady.
Keeps
coming. At one time, well, there aren't many houses in New Hope and Lambertville, and even in the surrounding country that I haven't been into one time or another in the last 50 years.
You made house calls.
Oh, yes. Yes. Fact of the matter is, I still did until I finally had to give it up, because even though I closed the office on January 15th, I told some of these older patients that I would still see them in the home once a month, as I had been doing. But I had to give that up because this malpractice insurance just overwhelming. I mean, I couldn't charge them the price that I'd have to charge them to pay for the malpractice insurance. So I had to give that up.
It really is.
Well, that's what's causing all the.
But up and down South Main Street over there in Lambertville, every other house where youngsters run out and yell at me as I go by, kids that I had delivered.
I can remember the feeling when the doctor would come to the home. It was like something.
I was a senior in high school, I was ill. In fact, I was in bed for 10 weeks. And during that time, had a rather bad episode. And the local doctor and his brother were down to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul Automobile Show. So he was out of town. But the other doctor came and saw me, and everything turned out all right. And the next day, early in the morning, they drove back that night, 365 miles. And the next morning, I heard these footsteps coming up the stairs, and I knew it was Dr. Lynn coming to see me. And he brought me the automobile show issue of the Motor magazine, which is a tremendous, great big thing. And he said, I brought you something to look at. He said, just put it on a pillow and don't try to see it, look at it all at one time. Just take your time, look at it a little at a time. This is too heavy. And he stood there at the foot of the bed and talked to me and explained what he'd seen and all. My sister came home that noon and I said, you know, that must be a wonderful profession for anybody to be able to do somebody as much good as he did me. He didn't even put a hand on me. He didn't come even to the side of the bed. He just stood there and talked to me, and I felt like a new person. And up until that time, I was going to go into electrical engineering, and I think that was the thing that decided me to go into medicine.
Oh, wonderful. And how many times you have multiplied that kindness in your own life now? It must give you...
Well, it's been a tough last few months here. When you figure these people come in, well, what are we going to do? I've been a patient for 35 years. I've been a patient for 40 years. What are we going to do? You can't do this. You can't quit until I die. Well, my nurse, of course, she's been with me for 23 years this time. She came here originally and I met her out in South Dakota because she worked for my sister when she was going to high school. And after she graduated from high school, she thought she'd go into nurses training. And I said, well, why don't you come back and work for us for a while and get a little exposure and decide for sure that that's what you want. The day after she graduated from high school, she came to New Hope, or to Philadelphia by bus. That was the 31st of May, because in 1936, my oldest daughter was born at 6 o'clock in the morning and she arrived at noon.
Oh, my goodness.
And she was with us for 2 years then and went back in nurses training and then came back here and she got a job down at General Motors and she married John Jager. I delivered her 3 daughters. She came back and then my other nurse had a baby, and when she went out to maternity leave, Mary Ellen came to relieve her, and then Janet decided she didn't better stay home, take care of the baby, so Mary Ellen was stuck with the job and she's been with me for 23 years.
Oh, goodness. Now, Mary Ellen, what is her last name?
Mary Ellen Jager it was, then she married Chamberlain. But the patients, the patients know her as Mary Ellen Jager, and we facetiously, the patient, I would say, who do you want to see, Dr. Jager or me?
Oh, I think that's wonderful. Well, who has taken your practice? Has anyone taken it?
No, we're telling the patients to decide where they want to go and referring them to whoever they decide to. There's no one specifically taking it.
Well, you were down at the shore, and they expected you back.
Oh, that was Dan.
That was my son, Dan.
Oh, I see.
You see,
I had
three daughters, and we lost their mother in 1948. Then this lady came to the area. She was teaching English down at Beaver College, and she became ill, and so they called another doctor who was day off, so they couldn't get him, so in second choice they called me, and I went to see her. And we got acquainted that way. Of course, they say you shouldn't get emotionally involved with your patients.
Yes.
But we did. And then we got married. We had virtually 2 sets of twins. The oldest boy and the oldest daughter were the same age. My middle daughter and the younger boy were the same age.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we had five children.
And they're still in the, are they all in the area?
No.
No.
His oldest daughter, Joan, our oldest daughter.
Joan.
Had cancer.
Joan's the one that passed away in 44.
She didn't tell anyone about it.
She didn't.
Not even her husband.
We speak about the economy. I had this back in 33. These patients would come sit in the waiting room waiting for their turn with their dollar bill rolled up in their hand, smelling kerosene to high heavens. Well, they heated their houses with these kerosene space heaters. I was adamant about those things. In fact, I have a patient now that he says, I remember the first time you came to see us over in South Main Street, you came in and you started sniffing and said, get that thing the hell out of here. And he says, well, what you do, you'd go in there, they'd have this space heater, no vent on it, burning up all the oxygen. They'd have every window and every door caulked with old newspapers or old rags, so there wasn't any bit of fresh air getting into the place. No wonder they were all sick. Wonder the more of them didn't die.
Well, some of them did. In fact, I remember when they used to use naphtha. Oh, how about children now grown? You see children that
As a matter of fact, the last couple of years that I was delivering babies was very gratifying because I would say, maybe a third of them that I was delivering, either the mother or the father, and in many instances, both the mother and father had been my previous baby. It was very, very gratifying. I'd deliver the baby, put it up on the mother's abdomen on the delivery table. I'd say, another grandchild, and the nurses said, Well, I don't know much about it now. They make such a complicated procedure out of it. Of course, you know, it was very expensive to have a baby in those days. It was $25. That included the prenatal visits and the delivery and the postpartum follow-up afterwards. Well, now you can't stick your nose in the doctor's door for $25.
Absolutely.
Well, I can remember when I first used to send patients to the university hospital, I'd send them down on the ward. They'd want the $25 deposit when they came in. At the hospital, $25 deposit when they came in.
Oh, you mean if they came in to deliver?
No, this was sending a patient in for the ward patient, not as a maternity, but as a medical or surgical patient.
And so is that the hospital that you used? Is that the hospital?
No, that you sometimes. Actually, in those days, I used to use Abington a great deal, and the hospitals in Trenton. Then we began to get more specialists and more variety of help over in Doylestown. Of course, that's where we practically all the patients have been referred to Doylestown. We have very good rapport with the Doylestown doctors, and we have very fine doctors over there. And everybody who's ever gone to other bigger hospitals and has then come back to Doylestown say that's where they want to go. Treat you like a human being, not a number.
Exactly, or something in a test tube.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying enough without that implacable.
And I asked, how about weather problems? How about getting around in the snow?
Well, that used to be a problem too, because they didn't used to clean off the roads like they do today. I can remember one time I was down on that road off of Brownsburg, and I got stuck. So I got out of the car. In those days, they had a throttle that you could pull out on the dash, pull out for the gas. And I put the thing in gear and pulled the throttle out. The back wheels were spinning. And I got out and started rocking the car all of a sudden it took hold and I almost lost the car. I did catch up to it and jump in and throw the thing out of gear, so but I almost lost the car going up the road.
How about the flood? Wasn't there a bad flood in 56?
55. As a matter of fact, yes. We had water in our basement here, but it was coming in through the subterranean water, not over the top of the ground.
But the river was here on our front steps.
And in fact, the matter is, in the afternoon they used to keep me posted about what the crest would be, and at 7 o'clock it was supposed to crest 5 feet higher. And Mike was here, the younger boy, and I said, "Mike, you're about 5 feet." Yeah, I had one of these sight levels. I said, "You go down to the water's edge, down by in Cryer's Lane down here, and sight back on the fence, and tell me where that level is." Well, he did that. I said, "Well, that shows the water won't ever come into the first floor. It'll come into the yard, but it won't be high enough to come in the first." And that was true. We sat on the front porch with our feet in the water, but it didn't come into the house. Although some of our friends came and said, "You've got to get this furniture all off of this first floor." But nobody came to help us bring it back again. But they did come.
They were very splendid by getting it off.
They did come.
Thank goodness they couldn't get the piano off. We had enough trouble getting the other stuff back.
As a matter of fact, Mike and Bruce DeCourcy took my canoe. I said, "Well, now that's the first time I've seen a boat of any kind on South Main Street." In the flood in 36, I had seen boats on North Main Street, but never on South Main Street. But they put the canoe in the right in the water, right off, right in front of our house here, and went sailing in the into the stream up the river at the canoe.
Well, and the stream was so it was the river.
We had a rather interesting experience. Al Debris had the country store here, and he came over to see me. He was in tears. He said, "I'm ruined." "What's the problem, Al?" He said, "Well, I've just gotten my walk-in freezer filled. I've gotten the cold, my freezing freezers filled. Everything is full of frozen food, and the power is off." I said, "Al, you get busy and get everything out of there. Take an inventory of everything you're taking out of there and take it up to the high school." I said, "The Red Cross is using that as an emergency kitchen. They're going to be feeding people. They can use that stuff, but you take it up there and get rid of it and take an inventory, and they will reimburse you for it." Well, he was eternally grateful for me. I just saved his neck. Then that evening, when the river was so high, Jim McGill had a boat with a rather powerful outboard motor on it. They would go down the stream about where the cannon is, turn around, and then come up against the river, against the stream, because it was coming so fast. They would turn the boat into the store, what is now the village store, and jump out of the boat, and they'd be in water up to their hips, and start taking stuff off the shelves and take it over here in front of the Tony Sark shop. You see, there was up the hill there, take it over there and unload it, and then they would come with trucks and pick it up there and take it up to the high school and distribute it.
Were there many people forced out of their homes?
Oh, yes.
Why they
were
actually, in fact, they kept issuing warnings here that anybody between the canal and the river should leave, that you should vacate your house. Well, I said, "Well, I'm not going to." Well, of course, Mrs. Leiby was busy because she headed the Red Cross, and she was out manning the Red Cross activities. All the kids were out directing traffic, and they were volunteering somewhere. And I said, "Well, I'm going to stay."
Yeah, I said, "All of Upper Bucks County." And when the storm started, I was down playing bridge at the beach, at our beach house. And Ken says, "Get up here." I said, "Why, what's the matter?" It was a gorgeous day, sunshine. He said, "The Red Cross needs to be here." And then told me what was happening. And from then on, I wasn't in my own house with a cellar full of water. And I had to go to Upper Black getting in all along.
Her sister, her twin sister, and her two daughters happened to be down here that weekend, too. They were out helping. Everybody was helping. And the lights were all out. The power was off. Well, there was a rap at the front door, and I went to the front door, and here was Jim Skillman, had thrown his shoulder out of joint. And I said, "Well, come on in, lie down." I had him lie down on the front hall, put my foot up into his axle and reduced the dislocation, got his shoulder back. And about that time, my niece came in the back door, and she saw these figures lying on the floor in the front hallway, just could see the shadows. She thought someone come in and attack me, had me down on the
this
floor.
This was our advertising.
Here I was putting Jim's shoulder back in place.
They tried.
Oh, did they? Oh.
Yeah, talk about primal scream.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, they tried, and I
better stop interrupting because you're not getting what your questions
are. I thought so.
Oh, not at all. We love having you here.
Thank
really.
You.
Oh, how about social differences in patients, like in the early New Hope community? When did this become partially
you think it is?
Oh, I think it is weekends, especially. Yeah.
Well, of course, when I first came here back in the 30s, early 40s, we knew everybody. And Dr. Flood is gone. Mrs. Flood is newer. I'm the oldest resident on Main Street. Used to be we knew everybody. I made it as far as now I can go up Main Street and not know anybody hardly. It's a very volatile population.
Right.
It comes and goes.
I think when you're used to, Middletown America, that can be, what would be considered a normal American city. When you come to New Hope, you realize this is a different community.
Well, it was more like that at first. In fact, I grew up in a small Midwestern town, and where you knew everybody. Of course, my father had the drugstore, and I almost worked in the drugstore where you get approximation. I mean, you got contact with people, too, all the time. But at first, the first few years, you did know everybody, but it's gotten to the point now where the population is so volatile. You don't, many of them aren't here 1 or 2 years, and they're replaced. Well, I hope it doesn't change.
I hope it doesn't, too. I think, of course, there will be changes. Don Hedges said, of course, there will be. It may become like Jenkintown was 50 years ago or something. That was a little paradise. It will probably change, too. But that's what the future holds, no matter what. We can't live with that bad account. How would the plans of the
in the 40s, we were terribly busy here. In fact, they were drafting doctors around the community. At one time, the draft board, one of the members of the draft board called me one night, and he said, just what is the situation over there in doctors in relationship with New Hope? And I told him, he said, well, your name came up, and it says you were subject to be drafted. But he said, I got to thinking about it, and I wanted to inquire. And I said, well, of course, we're here on the river. We serve both sides of the river, New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And I told him what the doctors had been taken out of the area. And he said, well, and at that time, then he went to bat, he told him, and that was the only thing that kept me from being drafted, too, because we were taking care of Jersey as well as Pennsylvania. At that time, I used to cover as far up as Frenchtown. We used to go down to Yardley. I used to go up to Flemington. I used to go over to Newtown. Yeah, and we were making house calls all the time in those days, too. But I'd get out of here and go in the car, go up to Frenchtown.
Really? Oh, that's a trip. Did you have office hours at a scheduled
yes.
time, and then, and even operate here, and then in addition to that,
you know, well, any of the operating, I mean, the tonsillectomy stuff, we do them early in the morning, then start office hours 8 to 10, then I'd get out from 10 to 2, would be making house calls, and from 4 to 7, I'd be making house calls and eating my dinner.
Oh, my.
It's a wonder I didn't have an ulcer.
An ulcer or a heart attack? How about patients in the hospital? Did you send patients?
Mostly, yes. I hardly ever, I had occasion, but mostly I sent patients to other people because I didn't have time enough to take care of them in the hospital. Except maternities. Occasionally. It began more gradually, then get more and more of them in the hospital. Well, we used to at one time, practically every house over there on South Main Street in Lambertville, I had a baby coming out of it.
Really?
No, well, of course we used the sulfa drugs first.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I did tell you about the fellow, the sulfa.
Yeah. But it was in World War II that they started using penicillin, wasn't it?
And
sulfa?
Then we began penicillin. And it was hard to come by. This isn't a personal thing, except for the fact that this fellow that I went through school with, it was more like a brother to me. His daughter, he was teaching down at Vanderbilt, and his daughter became ill, and they had her on penicillin. Every time they put her on penicillin, you could see everything started to get better. They'd run out of penicillin, and then it started getting worse, and they finally lost her because they couldn't get enough penicillin. I've always had
Pardon me? What was it though?
I think she had a subacute, well, what you call it, bacterial endocarditis. She had an infection in the heart, and at that time they were wasting penicillin on their service, the servicemen. I mean, they'd go off duty, and they'd come back, they were just routinely giving them shots of penicillin so they wouldn't be contracting venereal disease. And they were just wasting a lot of that penicillin over there. And here this little girl died because she couldn't get enough of it. Take it for granted. They have their difficulties too. One time I had this patient, and I always asked the patient if she'd ever have any reaction to penicillin. No, she didn't. So I gave her the shot of penicillin, she went home to Lambertville, and so happened that her husband was supposed to pick up something in Trenton for her. And he'd forgotten what it was, and he saw her go back home, so he followed her home, fortunately enough. And when he got there, she was practically out. And he got her, he went into the house to call me, and I said, get her over here as fast as you can. But before she got here, the nurse and I had syringes loaded with everything, penicillin ace and adrenaline and all everything we could think of to counteract this thing. And he brought, carried her in and put her on the table, and we started, the nurse and I both started shooting her with one thing or another, and he kept saying, is she going to be all right? Is she going to be all right? Well, frankly, I didn't answer him because I wasn't sure what the answer should be. It scared the daylights out of us. Well, that was, and she had never had a reaction to penicillin before that. That was about the beginning of my stopping to use penicillin injections. We used to use it just promiscuously, give injections of penicillin. I told that to one of the meetings we went to, and one of these doctors says, oh my God, he said, the last patient was in tonight, I gave her a shot of penicillin, put her out one door, and I went out the other to come to this meeting. He says, I hope she's all right.
Really, we don't realize how many, too, how many people are allergic or have developed allergies to the Wonder Drug.
That's right.
They have been one in many cases because of people who are so allergic to Wonder Drugs today.
They have been a wonder drug, there's no question, but they have had their side effects too.
So, how about the 60s and the hippie generation? Did you have to deal with hippies in New Hope? I wasn't here at that time, and I can see that this kind of town would sort of be a draw to them, sort of like a magnet.
Well, maybe I didn't get my share of them because I wasn't very tolerant toward them. Maybe that kept them from coming here. But, of course, we used to and get the venereal diseases that you'd have to see. But, bad times, there's no question about that. I don't know if we're any better. Maybe we're becoming more tolerant, that's all.
I think that we're changing a great deal from the 60s and the hippies.
Yes, even this cohabitation that we put up with today that was frowned upon years ago, we accept it today.
Yeah, we accept it, and we even accommodate it socially by having certain etiquette involving living together arrangements. It's strange how society changes. But how about, and I have down here too, about American moral codes and how they have changed in the last, do you think that we're getting any better for it? Do you think that society is suffering for the kind of
of course, one big argument is that it's better to have this trial error or trial period to find out if they're going to be compatible when they're married than to just run into a marriage and find out they're not compatible. I don't know. I'm a little old-fashioned. I can't buy that too much. I still think I go by the old standards, and I can't buy it. I can't tolerate it. I guess I'm just old-fashioned.
Well, I don't think it's old-fashioned. I think society had rules for reasons. And I think that the generation today has really decided that they don't want to know the reasons, that they have reasons of their own. I think that they feel that there is more sexual honesty today. And I think it's just plain.
I don't know. It's a little bit too much freedom, I think. There is no responsibility. They can get entangled and walk away from it without any responsibility. There are too many illegitimate children being born in the world today.
And to very young parents.
Yes.
Their child parents.
Single parents.
Single parents and parents who are just too young to handle that responsibility.
Right.
They want something to cuddle and love, like teddy bears. It's really sad. I don't know what the solution is.
Well, it's an era that we'll have to go through, I guess.
What do you see for the future of this wonderful town of ours? I know that we've had, we haven't talked about many of the people in the area that you have certainly encountered, and I wondered if you mentioned Jim McGill in particular. Why Jim McGill?
Well, Jim has taken interest in the history, and he's collected a lot of historically interesting photographs. Jim has, I think Jim probably would be considered an outstanding historian of New Hope. And he's lived here all his life.
Right.
I used to take care of his mother and his father. His father was a physician.
I understand.
Yes.
He was also in politics.
Oh, yes. In fact, the matter is Dr. McGill and Dr. Flood used to exchange mayorship of New Hope. One would have it one term, one would have it the next term.
I'm very impressed with all your lovely paintings, and you showed them to me before we started recording, but I wondered if you could talk about some of the artists that you have now here.
Well,
above you here,
Daniel Garber and I were very good friends. It was more than a doctor-patient relationship. We were very good friends. This was the first, my ambition was to get the collection of paintings by the local artist representing local scenes. And this was the first one that I acquired from Daniel Garber.
The one about him here?
The big one, yes.
Is that a particular scene that I should recognize?
You wouldn't. It was from a... This is the canal along here. It's down on the back of Main Street, down below Mechanic Street.
Oh, I see. And the one above,
and the one above, of course, is from here, shows Lambertville across the river.
That's beautiful. They're both lovely. There's such a misty quality about them.
Well, he was, in fact, he was a very versatile artist. He could do anything. You saw the etchings upstairs, and you saw the sketching, the pencil sketch. One time he had a little heart attack, and I grounded him one winter, and he spent most of his time sitting down next to the fireplace in the living room. And one time he got to looking at the firewood. There were a lot of apple logs. And he picked one up and he started carving. And he carved some of the disciples with their flowing robes and their staffs all in one piece. I mean, this was out of one log. They were beautifully done things. He was a very versatile man. He could do anything. Yes.
And it was a shore scene.
Well, Lathrop built that boat up here at where the Phillips Mill is. He lived across the road from the Phillips Mill. He built that boat up there, put it into the river, floated it down, took it across the canal over in toward New York, and went up to New England. And he used to go around the waters up there in New England and do these scenes from his boat. And it was from that boat that he was on that he described that last episode that took his life.
And you have the letter here, or the log from
his... The log from his, the last three pages out of his log.
And And what was it? Was it a wave, do you think, that washed him overboard?
Well, the hurricane hit.
The hurricane hit him. Oh, my. Now, I understand he's got, he had a daughter living in France, and...
Well, and his son was... And his son and his family lived there, and these are grandchildren of him.
And who is Anne later?
Well, I think Anne is a grandchild.
Oh, she's a grandchild, I see. What about Redfield? Do you have a Redfield?
No, unfortunately, I do not have a Redfield.
But you do have a Leith?
Two Leith Rosses, and I have an oil of Leith Rosses. I have two Nutta Makers, both... Kenneth and his father.
Oh, this
and this is Sodder.
That's Sodder.
Sodder.
And that's spelled S-O-D?
And
that
T-T. Sodder.
Sodder.
This was the one. This one of the cumulus cloud here. He himself was so fond of that. He said, "I had another one that I'd given to my sister-in-law, and I wanted one to give to Mary for to match this one, the size of his frame and all." And I went out and I saw this one, and he was so enthused with that, he said, "I think that's the best cloud I've ever done."
Isn't that beautiful? You also have some
Ranoff by that one, yes. This is a Follansbee here. This one of the bridge back there is a Follansbee.
I see this lovely house, too, has been copied many times. Now, this Follansbee in the corner, you told me, was the artist had taken some license.
No, this was that. That's not the. That's the Follansbee is that one back there.
The Canal Bridge.
Yeah. The other one here was the one that was in the McCall magazine.
Oh,
Bill Smith. Bill Smith did that.
Yes.
Sort of an accumulation of house here, our house, the building over in Doylestown, and the church I think is out there in Buckingham with several additions to it from.
Oh, it's beautiful. Was that just in the magazine or was it?
It was a center page of McCall's magazine.
Oh, such beautiful
things in that. Centerfold.
Yeah. And
I told you about the one of our house that from Snell. Yes, that she gave me.
Oh yeah,
after.
She had two Snell.
No, that two Leith Rosses.
Oh, you
had Snell is the one that she gave me when he passed away. He said, "Henry wants thee to have something."
Oh, tell me that again. That was wonderful.
Well, the night that he passed away, she, little bit of a thing, about 4 feet tall, just said, "Doctor, come with me," and took me into the other room over there. They lived in the apartment up over the bank building, and reached over the couch, took that off, and says, "Henry wants thee to have this." Shows our house, you see, down there, the picture of our house.
Yes, it's a beautiful painting. It's very
They were quite anxious to get that. In fact, they had that on exhibit at the museum in Allentown when they had that exhibit up there this last year from the Bucks County artist. Yes.
Yes. And it was nice of you to loan it to them, but I bet you worried about it.
Well, they wanted to take it on tour for a whole year, and I didn't want it. I was afraid to. Even though they had it insured for $10,000, I was still afraid to have it go on. That's a Bill Taylor. That one there is the Cuttalossa house up at the Cuttalossa Creek.
Oh,
the Bill Taylor. That's a palette knife.
Oh, geez. Really?
Yes. Cuttalossa Creek, yes.
It's just beautiful. And I think Whittier has written poetry about it. And I understand Pike, General Pike, spent his boyhood there, was raised in that area.
No, you wasn't aware of that.
This is what I'm picking up in the oral history. This is where he was raised, right in that area. Someone said where, and they said, "Oh, just beyond the bridge." I think I've just about overstayed.
I have something to show you that